This week we will be studying 1 Kings 20. In this chapter, Israel's king Ahab goes to war with Ben-Hadad of Aram, and with God's favor, he thwarts him in not one, but two campaigns. Ahab fell short, though, in that he ultimately made peace with Ben-Hadad rather than obeying God's command to kill him. In examining the story, we find that God demands obedience, and that the consequences for failing to obey can be swift and dire. The passage for consideration is 1 Kings 20, and if you have not read it yet, now is an excellent time to pause and do so. Today's passage opens at the beginning of a fresh round of conflict between Aram's king Ben-Hadad and Israel's king Ahab. We've seen the name Ben-Hadad before. He first appeared during the reign of Asa back in 1 Kings 15, when Asa paid him to break his alliance with Baasha, king of Israel. In that episode, Ben-Hadad conquered a handful of cities in northern Israel. The relationship between Israel and Aram had been strained since that point. However, the Ben-Hadad in today's story is not the same Ben-Hadad as in the previous one. In verse 34 of today's chapter, chapter 20, this new Ben-Hadad references, quote, the cities that my father took from your father, end quote. So this new Ben-Hadad is the son of the old Ben-Hadad, and they just share the same name. We don't know exactly what year this battle occurred in, but if I've got my timeline correct, it had been anywhere from 27 to 44 years since the first Ben-Hadad had taken over these cities. So this new Ben-Hadad is the son of the old Ben-Hadad, and they just share the same name. The new Ben-Hadad mustered an impressive force of 32 kings. My supposition is that these were kings in the sense that they were the leaders of local areas, not entire nations or sprawling empires. I suppose that because 32 is such a large number of kings. This number is comparable to the number of kings killed by Joshua. Joshua 12 records that Joshua had defeated 31 kings west of the Jordan, but those were kings of cities, not something larger. So I suspect that's what we're dealing with here. Ben-Hadad's collection of 32 kings is still impressive, though. The northern kingdom of Israel could not match a number like that. They brought their horses and their chariots and advanced across Israel's territory. They reached Samaria, the capital, and besieged it. Ahab was in a bad position, and so Ben-Hadad offered Ahab his terms of peace. They were not kind terms. Ben-Hadad had come to plunder, and he intended to follow through on that. He demanded that Ahab give up all of his gold and silver, as well as the best of his wives and children. And by the way, the pronominal suffix here is singular, so we are talking about just Ahab's family and medals, not everyone's. I, for one, would not have turned over my children to slavery or my women to some harem. I would have preferred to fight to the death. A man who won't defend his people isn't much of a man. I might be a little more likely to hand over the gold, but not much. But Ahab was more self-serving, or perhaps just more pragmatic. The well-being of his wives and children, I suppose, mattered not so much to him as his own skin, or maybe he just saw the writing on the wall. He didn't think that he could win the battle, and it would be better to give his wives and children away than to fight and watch them all be slaughtered. Whatever his exact motivations, he relented. Ahab addressed Ben-Hadad as his lord and accepted his terms. But then Ben-Hadad decided those terms weren't good enough. His offer had been accepted too quickly, I suppose, and so he figured he could have gotten more. He reneged on the deal, demanding that Ahab not only send his wives and children in silver and gold, but also that Ben-Hadad's servants be allowed to go through Ahab's house and the houses of his servants to take anything they wished. That put Ahab into a very bad position. Where would it all end? If he accepted this new deal, would Ben-Hadad just come back and ask for more? Even if he didn't, would Ahab's people tolerate having their homes ransacked for any and everything of value? Ahab brought the offer to his advisors, along with his assessment that Ben-Hadad was just looking for trouble, eager to pick a fight no matter how Ahab tried to cooperate. The elders agreed, telling Ahab that he should stick with the first offer and not accept the second. Ben-Hadad was displeased with this. It might seem that Ben-Hadad would have just gone ahead and accepted the terms. After all, he had formerly offered taking wives, children, and gold. Why weren't they good enough now? I wonder if Ben-Hadad made the first offer just to size Ahab up. He must have figured, if this guy will give me his wives, then he'll definitely be afraid, and if that's the case, we can get whatever we want. Once he knew that Ahab was weak, Ben-Hadad was prepared to take anything he wanted, whether Ahab wanted to give it or not. And so Ben-Hadad gave the classic self-maledictory oath. He threatened to crush Samaria into dust, pounded so fine and scattered so thoroughly that there wouldn't even be enough of it left for each of his men to carry out a handful of it. A hyperbolic trash-talking claim, to be sure. In doing so, he called on the gods to do as much to him if he did not do it to Samaria. The man was set on war, and nothing would turn him back. Ahab responded through his messengers with a little trash talk of his own. Let not him who straps on his armor boast himself as he who takes it off, meaning, don't boast about winning a battle before you actually win it, because you may not survive the battle and thus get to take your armor off at the end of it. Or, to deprive it of all class, shut up and come out here to fight because I'm going to kill you. Ben-Hadad was in his tent drinking with his kings when the message came down, and when he heard it, he ordered the soldiers to take their positions. Incidentally, drinking on the battlefield is not a good idea. Military leaders need to have their wits about them to make good decisions, so this does not bode particularly well for Ben-Hadad. We note that even the initiation of the battle didn't stop Ben-Hadad from drinking. He was highly overconfident of his ability to win this battle without much effort. Israel was badly outnumbered, and Ahab's confidence is what had led him to make such audacious demands in the first place. Meanwhile, back in Samaria, a prophet of Jehovah delivered a message to Ahab. And that bodes well for Ahab. We recall that it had not been long before this that in Ahab's kingdom, Jehovah's prophets were being killed and forced into hiding, with Ahab taking his advice from the prophets of Baal. Of course, Elijah had killed the prophets of Baal at the brook Kishon following the contest on Mount Carmel. In that event, it appeared that Ahab had acknowledged Jehovah as the true God. While Elijah had been forced to go on the run for killing the prophets of Baal, that is, running from Jezebel, apparently his actions in that episode had been effective at bringing about change in the kingdom. The prophets of Jehovah were back in the good graces of the king, and the king was apparently turning to Jehovah. And Jehovah's message to Ahab from this prophet was a good one. Jehovah would be proving himself by giving Ahab victory in this asymmetrical battle. The prophet also gave the battle plans, telling Ahab to make the first attack and telling him which soldiers to send. Ahab sent some 7,000 men. And that is a shockingly small number. For some comparison, according to 1 Kings 12:21, only 8 chapters before this one and not even 100 years prior to this event, Judah, Israel's counterpart to the south, had been able to raise an army of 180,000 men. Now that's a number for Judah, not Israel, but presumably Israel should have had forces that were somewhat comparable. Ahab's army here isn't even 4% of that size. So either Israel is fighting with only a small portion of their army, or they had been really badly battered back since the split with Judah. But then we might expect that. Israel had been at war with some degree of regularity with both Aram to the northeast and Judah to the south. Israel had also been racked with internal turmoil and civil war. To top it off, they'd just experienced over 3 years of drought. So Israel was significantly weaker than they had been at the split. Ben-Hadad was still drinking himself drunk in his tent when Israel's soldiers marched out onto the battlefield and began their attack. Ben-Hadad, clearly still overconfident, received the news of the attack lightly. He didn't even want his soldiers to kill the attacking army, but simply to capture them alive. Perhaps he thought they would make good bargaining chips or sources of intelligence. Maybe he was trying to be merciful since he believed the war would be over quickly. Or maybe he was just drunk and not thinking clearly. Ben-Hadad's men went out with orders to capture and not kill, and Israel went out to destroy. The Israelites gave the Arameans a serious pounding, killing their opponents and putting them to flight. The Arameans were defeated, but Ben-Hadad and his kings escaped. I'm sure that for Ahab, a recent convert to the worship of Jehovah, having this victory was a big encouragement and a demonstration of Jehovah's favor. But Ben-Hadad had escaped, and the prophet correctly predicted that Ben-Hadad would return again the next year. This was no time to party. It was time to make preparations for the next attack. And the prophet was correct. Back in Aram, Ben-Hadad and his servants were plotting. Ben-Hadad's Aramean advisors correctly assessed that divine intervention had helped Ahab win the battle, but they lacked understanding of why and how. They supposed that Jehovah was a god of the mountains. From their religious worldview, that makes some sense. They believed in many gods. By necessity, no one of many gods could be infinitely powerful over everything. If there were multiple gods, then they would balance each other out, this one more powerful in this way, and that one more powerful in that way. They also had regional gods. This god was the god of this nation, and that god was the god of that nation, and so forth. We have seen Jehovah often showing himself on the mountains. He appeared on Mount Sinai. He appeared on Mount Carmel. The people worshipped him in the high places. So, the Arameans supposed that Jehovah must be a god of the mountains. Their plan then was to avoid Jehovah's wrath by having battles on the plains, where they supposed Jehovah either couldn't or wouldn't help Israel. That, of course, is not helpful advice. They miscalculated in that Jehovah is not just some regional god among many gods who has limited power over the hill country. He is the one and only God who has all power over all things. So this strategy would not work. They also recommended some changes to the military hierarchy. The kings, political leaders, had led the last battle, and they had made a pretty poor showing. Being drunk in the tents as the battle started was not exactly good military leadership. Ahab's advisors recommended that next time he leave the kings at home and send actual military commanders. They were confident that if Ben-Hadad would do this and bring back an army the same size as before, that he would win the battle. Their confidence was misplaced. But when spring came, Ben-Hadad tried again. His army, significantly outnumbering Israel's, went out to the plains, and Israel's army went to face them. Israel's army was small and weak, such that the passage compares them to only two little flocks of goats. One would expect that a large army would be able to defeat a few flocks of goats, but God had different ideas. The battle lines were drawn at Aphek. The exact location of Aphek is not certain, and apparently there were multiple cities with that name. My best guess here is that this was a city on the plains north of Mount Carmel in Asher's territory. That fits with the context. This was an area with plains in the northern part of the land where Arameans would be able to mount an attack. A prophet went to King Ahab and told him that he would be successful in the battle. He would be successful because it would glorify God for him to be so. The Arameans had claimed that Jehovah could not win on the plains, and so Jehovah intended to give Ahab the victory to prove that he was not some mere god of the hills. God would glorify himself. The passage doesn't say it explicitly at this point in the narrative, but the ending of the chapter makes it clear that Ahab was also given instructions that he should devote Ben-Hadad to destruction, killing him rather than letting him leave the battle alive. For 7 days, the two armies camped opposite of each other before the battle began. We don't have word on how many troops there were among the Israelites, but they killed 100,000 Arameans. Apparently, some of the escaping Arameans holed up in Aphek, where they found themselves under siege with Israel working to tear down the city's walls. A collapse of the wall killed 27,000 more men. So this was a huge victory for Israel. Lots of people killed. As for Ben-Hadad, he was hiding out at the inner part of the city, where he and his servants could see that this matter was not going to end well for them. They recommended that Ben-Hadad go and beg for mercy, since historically the kings of Israel had been reputed for being merciful. It would be better for Ben-Hadad to surrender and hope that Ahab would spare him than to just wait for Israel's army to kill him. And so Ben-Hadad's advisors went, dressed in sackcloth with ropes around their heads. Sackcloth was the rough cloth used for making a sack, hardly suitable for clothing, and a rope makes a poor hat. This way of dressing screamed, "I'm poor and miserable and mourning, lacking even a single shred of dignity." They said to Ahab that Ben-Hadad asked that Ahab would let him live, and Ahab was merciful. He quickly accepted this as an admission of defeat and declared Ben-Hadad to be his brother. He sent for Ben-Hadad and brought him up into his chariot, where the two discussed terms of peace. Ben-Hadad agreed to restore the cities that his father had taken in the previous generation, and he also opened up Damascus for Israel to sell their goods there, a significant economic benefit. And thus the two came to peaceful terms. Ahab let Ben-Hadad go. The trouble is that this is not what God wanted. So now one of the sons of the prophets started making waves. It is notable that there is now a group of people in the narrative called sons of the prophets. It wasn't so long ago in the narrative that the prophets were all facing death and hiding out in caves, but apparently after Mount Carmel, prophecy was having a real resurgence. Elijah had called Elisha, and judging by later passages, Elisha had put together a whole cohort of prophets. Some of this makes me question just how strictly we're defining the term prophet in this book. Generally, the most strict definition of the word would describe a human who hears some message from God and must then report it to the people on God's behalf, However, it seems abnormal to have so many prophets all in concentration. I suppose that some of these might have been prophets in a less literal sense. Like, for example, some of them might have been disciples of Elijah and Elisha, and they were called prophets or sons of prophets, despite not being prophets in the strictly literal sense. Some of these may also have been devout men and teachers of God's principles, but not recipients of some new revelation. There is biblical precedent for using the word prophet loosely. For example, Paul in Titus 1:12 cited a poet from Crete as, quote, one of their own prophets. Normally, we wouldn't think of a pagan poet as being a prophet, but in some very broad sense, with a poet being a person who publicly delivers some philosophically meaningful message, the title might be applied. Another example is Barnabas. That nickname means, most literally, son of a prophet. But Acts 4:36 gives the meaning son of encouragement. In that sense, a person who gives an encouraging word, if not a word of literal divine revelation, might be broadly considered a prophet. So we might find it strange that at this particular period of Israel's history there were so many prophets running around, but I would suggest that the word is probably being broadly applied. That said, this particular man seems to be a prophet in the more literal sense. He had a message for Ahab, which he prefaced with, "Thus says Jehovah." We get it in verse 42. The message is this: "Because you have let go out of your hand the man whom I had devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall be for his life, and your people for his people." The point, of course, being that since Ahab had let Ben-Hadad go, he and his people would be punished for it. But the prophet wouldn't just go out and say that. As biblical prophets often do, he would have a flair for the dramatic. He would put on a ruse to trick the king into condemning himself. This is not dissimilar to a tactic which we have seen previously. In 2 Samuel 12, Nathan the prophet confronted David in a similar manner, convincing David to pass judgment on someone else in a fake case and then applying the judgment to David. Here, the trick was that the prophet would pretend to be a soldier, injured in the battle, who let a captured enemy soldier escape. As the king would condemn him for having let an enemy soldier free, so the prophet would condemn Ahab for letting the enemy king go free. But to do that, the prophet would need to look the part of a soldier. He couldn't convincingly walk up to Ahab unscathed, and so, at God's command, he asked someone standing nearby to strike him. The man, surely bewildered by someone asking to be struck, refused to do so. Ignoring a prophet who speaks in God's name is a bad idea, though. In response, the prophet told him that, for his disobedience, a lion would eat him as soon as he departed. And that's exactly what happened. This is clearly a miraculous occurrence, since the odds of being eaten by a lion right after someone tells you you'll be eaten by a lion are quite bad. When the prophet turned to the next man, whom I suppose had seen what happened to the former, and asked him to strike him, that man quickly obeyed. There'd be no lion eating him. He struck the prophet sufficiently to injure him, and the prophet then covered his face with a bandage so that he had a convincing disguise. And he set his trap for the king by explaining to him a false scenario. He claimed that another soldier had brought him a captured soldier and told him to guard that soldier, threatening that if he let the prisoner go free, he would face either death or a hefty fine. But then he also claimed to have let the prisoner go free. The king pronounced the judgment. The one who let the prisoner go would suffer the penalty as described. And then the prophet sprang his trap. He removed his mask and delivered the punishment. Jehovah had called for Ben-Hadad to be devoted to destruction. That isn't mentioned elsewhere, but apparently it was the case. Since Ahab had let him go, he and his people would be punished. Ahab's life for Ben-Hadad's life, and the lives of his people for Ben-Hadad's people. And in the end, it would happen that way. In 1 Kings 22, two chapters from this one, Ahab would be killed in battle fighting against none other than the Arameans. But for now, he would live on. He went back to Samaria, sullen. In application, there are probably a few different things we could talk about here. We might discuss God's ability to affect the outcome of a battle and his willingness to do so to help his people for the sake of his own glory. It is the case that God is sovereign over all things and that he has the power to manipulate all of the variables, even human actions. He does, in fact, act for the sake of his own glory, and part of doing so means that he does things which benefit his people. We've been over that many times. We could talk about Ben-Hadad's foolishness of drinking alcohol, particularly during a time of war and on the battlefield. There's a message there about being overconfident as well. We could discuss at length God's mercy to Ahab. For some time, Ahab had been the worst king in Israel's history, But God had shown himself in the drought and proved himself supreme in the challenge at Mount Carmel, and Ahab responded to that. He apparently stopped the persecution of Jehovah's prophets and started listening to them. God showed himself to be merciful in that he accepted a penitent Ahab and began to help him rather than hurt him. We might also note that there should be only one law for both the soldier and the king. As the prophet demonstrated, if a penalty is fit for the soldier, it is fit for the king as well. Or maybe there's a message here about trusting the wrong people. Ben-Hadad spoke kind words, saying that he was Ahab's brother, but in reality it would not be long before Ben-Hadad killed him. But I think that the message that is more directly at the center of this passage is the necessity of total and immediate obedience to Jehovah. If God tells you to do something and you sit idly and ignore that command, or worse, if you act contrary, then there are real consequences for that. Sometimes those consequences are immediate and severe. Take, for example, the case of the man who was eaten by the lion. He received a command from a prophet delivered in God's name to strike him. The man refused. He neglected to do that duty. I won't speculate as to his motivation, since the passage gives none, but there were consequences for his negligence. The consequence was severe, death by lion. The consequence was also immediate. As soon as he left the prophet, he was eaten. There was no chance to repent and turn his life around. He failed to follow instructions, and the consequences were swift and severe. It won't always be that way, but often it is. Sin is like that. It is harmful, and that is why we should avoid it. It was the same for Ahab. He had his orders. Ben-Hadad was to be devoted to destruction, but Ahab wouldn't follow those orders. He chose to make peace with Ben-Hadad where Jehovah had called for destruction. The consequences were both swift and severe. The prophet announced them before Ahab had even returned home from the battle. And it would be the very next time that Ben-Hadad's army fought with Ahab that Ahab wouldn't live to tell about it. Sin has consequences. Even sins of omission have consequences. A sin of omission is not the sin that you actively commit, the doing something wrong. It is the sin which you passively commit, the failure to do something right. Even the sin committed by Ahab, the sin of being overly inclined to peace, has consequences. God doesn't offer us up a buffet of options in life. He doesn't tell us, don't do that so long as you feel like it. And he doesn't tell us, do this if you care to do so. He gives us his commands in his word, and he demands total and immediate obedience. Failure to obey can lead to sudden destruction for which there is no remedy. My strong advice to you then is that you not fall into the trap that Ahab fell into. Read God's word. Know what he says for you to do and not to do, and then put it into practice in your life. If you fail to do so, you may find yourself suddenly broken beyond all repair. To conclude, 1 Kings chapter 20 tells us the story of how Ben-Hadad's Aram attacked Ahab's Israel in two separate campaigns. Both of those campaigns went badly for Ben-Hadad, despite the fact that his forces significantly outnumbered Ahab's, because God gave Ahab the victory. God did this to demonstrate his power both to Ahab and to Ben-Hadad. He proved in his victory that he is something bigger than just some god of the hills. However, despite these victories, Ahab had unwittingly set the stage for his own end. Where he had been ordered to kill Ben-Hadad, he let him live and made a peace treaty with him. Ben-Hadad would not return the favor, as Aram's army would kill Ahab in a future battle. We recognize here that the consequences for disobeying God can be swift and severe, and for that reason, we should be sure to give God our full and immediate obedience. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.